Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, Boulder City Council held another round of discussions last night about the flood mitigation project in South Boulder and CU's plans for a future campus at the same site. We'll have more coming up after headlines. After that, a diversity and inclusion summit took place at CU Boulder yesterday. We'll get a report on some of the issues that were addressed. After that, we'll hear from a barista who works at a Starbucks concession at Denver International Airport. He's one of hundreds of workers at concession stands at DIA who are petitioning to join a union with a view to getting increased wages and better working conditions. Two regular Wednesday morning features, Make Them Hear You and Naturally with Brigitte Mars. Then after headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, we'll hear from a man who was incarcerated in a state prison in Colorado. But now he's an entrepreneur and he's helping other people who are still incarcerated by helping them sell their artwork. At 9 o'clock, as we continue our coverage for Black History Month, we'll bring you a special documentary. Martin Luther King Jr. is still on the case. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Last night, Broomfield City Council unanimously voted to give notice that they would be withdrawing as a municipal partner in the planned Jefferson Parkway. Broomfield's involvement over the past 12 years in the planned road construction project has been controversial and criticised by activists who are concerned about the plutonium that remains in the area from the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons site. The Denver Post reports that last summer the city cited an elevated reading of plutonium discovered along the proposed path of the highway as the chief reason behind its consideration of withdrawing from the project. Broomfield has been an official municipal partner in the Jefferson Parkway Authority since 2008. The official date of its exit from the partnership was not made clear at last night's meeting, as the city and county still need to send notification to the authority board of its decision. A new study by the City of Denver shows that 80% of teens do not use marijuana. Summer Taylor has more.
In 2019, Denver City officials surveyed 537 teens in order to assess the effectiveness of the high-cost youth marijuana prevention program. According to the latest survey results, 81% of respondents between 13 and 17 said that they do not currently use marijuana. The same survey shows that 61% of 18-year-olds do not currently use marijuana. The high-cost marijuana education and prevention campaign was launched by the City of Denver with a view to sparking conversations about marijuana among the city's youth. Ashley Kilroy, Executive Director of Denver Access and Licenses, and manager of the high-cost prevention campaign, told the Denver Post that it has been proven that providing effective education to teenagers about marijuana is far more effective than scare tactics. The number of teens who reported that they have never used marijuana dropped from 59% in 2018 to 57%. The high-cost campaign survey usage results illustrate a state trend showing in the latest Healthy Kids Colorado data from 2017, which found that 81% of teenagers in the state do not consume marijuana. From KGNU, I'm Summer Taylor.
Immigrant rights advocates in Colorado say there's an increase in federal immigration activity around so-called sensitive areas like schools. CIRC, the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition, said in a statement this morning that they have documented 3 confirmed cases in the state of ICE targeting fathers while they're on their way to school with their children. According to CIRC, its Rapid Response Network has confirmed the detention of a father in the Montbello area in Denver. They also say that yesterday a father in Durango was stopped, as well as one in southeast Denver. All the men, CIRC say, were stopped in their cars either en route to school with their children in the car or immediately after dropping their children off. CIRC and other immigrant rights advocates decry this tactic of targeting families and children during school drop-offs. They say it violates the spirit of the sensitive locations policies, which include schools. They say the point of the sensitive locations policy is to protect the safety of children and community members from the trauma of witnessing enforcement. In today's weather, expect highs in the low 40s under mostly sunny skies. Overnight, blustery conditions with the low in the low 20s. Tomorrow, highs in the mid 40s, sunny skies ahead for the rest of the week, and we may get to the mid 50s for Friday and Saturday. It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. It has been 7 years since the 2013 historic floods that killed four Boulder County residents and put many more in harm's way, as well as destroying 350 homes and damaging another 550, many in South Boulder. Well, since then, the city has been trying to solve flood mitigation for that area, and it tackled the issue again at a city council meeting last night. KGNU's Roz Brown has more.
It's been likened by some to a hostage situation. In order to do flood mitigation in South Boulder to protect lives and property, Boulder needs a portion of property owned by CU. CU is happy to oblige, but only if the city offers necessary annexation of its property at US 36 and Foothill Parkway, so it can eventually become the CU South Campus. But the city has never annexed property without knowing what a site plan will look like, and CU says it won't know that for several more years. That frustration led to a tense exchange at a city council study session last night, starting with Councilman Mark Wallach, who detailed CU's changing position on what it will and won't agree to.
I want to suggest that a lot of the uncertainty in these processes have come, frankly, from CU. My question is this simply the proposal du jour, or is this the one that you really, really mean? And how are we to judge the difference? My head is spinning as if I was Linda Blair in The Exorcist. I have no idea what it is you're actually committing to, and that distresses me.
CU representative for the project, Francis Draper, countered that a back and forth is part of any negotiation.
So I think we've been steadily at the table, and as I said, we're well on the way, I think, to a good agreement. I don't think the university has not been consistently at the table.
Well, you know, I believe we have a symbiotic relationship, not an adversarial one, and I have not seen enough
Which
of that symbiosis.
Yeah.
I have not seen enough of that symbiosis in some aspects of this process.
Councilmember Rachel Fran lives in South Boulder and made finalizing a flood mitigation plan the centerpiece of her 2019 campaign.
As a person in harm's way, again, just as I used to feel out there, I would say what I'm feeling at this table is that it's not CU holding anybody hostage. If we move down this very non-compromising road, it's going to be City Council holding community members hostage and being unprotected. So we've got to believe CU when they say something. They are a community partner. They are not the villain here. And I think we need to be respectful and savvy enough to appreciate that they do have a business interest. I don't think that they're holding us hostage, but I think we have to be reasonable negotiators as well.
Like Friend, Councilmember Adam Swetlick was elected in 2019 and also lives in South Boulder.
I live on the corner of Foothills and Baseline in a sub-ground level unit. I'm extremely aware of our flooding issues, and I still think it's okay to take some time to understand the holistic view of everything, to question the environmental impacts. It's worth having the conversations to me simply because it takes a little bit of hubris as a human to say, I am the most important at all points, my protection, despite the fact that I know I live in a flood area. It's got to be about me right now.
Another proposal preferred by some Boulder residents is for a land swap. Maybe there could be a CU North instead of a CU South, and the property at the gateway to Boulder could be left undeveloped but for the flood mitigation. Mayor Sam Weaver stressed the possible benefits.
Rachel asked this good question, what's the benefit? The land at CU South has been desired by this community for a very long time because it is such high quality habitat in some parts, and it was a gravel pit that never got reclaimed properly, and people love to go out there and recreate. So there would certainly be some benefits to the community of being able to make that permanently an amenity that they have rather than just temporarily an amenity they have.
CU, however, has said it doesn't want a land swap, and city staff admitted that it could take several more years to make that happen while South Boulder residents worry about their safety. The next council meeting on the CU South Flood Mitigation Project is scheduled for May. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
The 2020 Spring Diversity and Inclusion Summit took place at CU Boulder yesterday. One of the featured speakers was Callie Fajardo-Anstein. She's the author of the new book of short stories, Sabrina and Karina. Now, that's the book that was chosen this year for the Campus One book. KGNU's Rosanna Longo spoke with Callie Fajardo-Anstein about the themes explored in her book and her participation in the summit.
With Sabrina and Karina, one of the things I was trying to do was trying to insert Chicana narratives into a white space, which is literature of the American West. And there's no reason it should have been a white space. I mean, many of us are native to the region. We've been here as long, if not longer, than Anglos. And so I was really perplexed as to why we weren't more dominant in that space, or just more equal, not even dominant. And so I was really writing to try to move into that space. And it's been interesting being able to get there. I mean, it's been a long time. I think this book, it took over 10 years to get it where it is today. It took a long time to get it published. And now that it's had the success it's had, being nominated for the National Book Award and a number of other prizes, I literally go to white spaces. I mean, I go to universities and I go to these stages all across North America, and I bring these Chicanas with me. And I hope that by creating that pathway and that trail, there can be more people behind me who are entering into those spaces. And in the end, they won't be white spaces. They'll just be spaces for all of us.
So you're doing a disruptive way of approaching this lack of more literature that represent us. Would you also speak about, you know, what are you doing here today? What is the importance of this diversity summit and the moment of you sharing parts of your book?
Yeah, I think, I love that you said that it's just disrupting. Coming from a punk rock background, I mean, I really love that. But I think what I am doing here today is I'm hoping that I'm setting an example for one, that anyone can be a writer. It does not matter what kind of resources you come from, what kind of background. All you really need is a pen and a piece of paper. And so in that way, it's one of the most equitable art forms. And another thing that I'm hoping that I'm doing here today is giving people a glimpse into the lives and the souls of people they might not necessarily think about. And if they do think about them because they're their own people, I want them to have a sense of pride being able to see themselves reflected back in such a large way.
At the end of your speech, you talk about we are all human beings. We need to shed a light on that. Would you speak about that in the case of gender equality, females especially, and being a Chicana?
Yeah. One of the most interesting questions I get is why I decided to write a book about Chicanas and about women. And I always find that an odd question because we're human. I mean, of course, our subjectivity matters just as much as a man's subjectivity. But for some reason, for hundreds of years, thousands of years of being relegated to the margins, that humanity has sort of been skirted in a way. And so I think one of the most important things that we can do is to tell our stories and to just say, look, we are here, our lives and our stories matter just as much as yours, and they're on the same playing field as yours, and they deserve to be in these spaces.
Yes. Why is it so important to have a diversity summit here at CU Boulder?
Alphonse Keesley. I'm the associate vice chancellor who's in charge of this event and have been for the last decade. What's important about having the summit is that it's a public educational opportunity, that it isn't something about only being taught in certain classes. It's a way in which to reach all of the campus community for those who are willing to attend, as well as the city employees of the government to be able to attend. There was just one person who was here who bought the book by Kali, and she's from the city, which was just great for me to hear. It's like, okay, this is having the impact and relationship building that we want to have. So having it all the time is something that we want to make sure where people don't forget. This is an important matter for us all on the campus. We're still not where we want to be with regard to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and justice. So we're still working very hard at making sure that this remains up front for our campus community and our colleagues from the city government.
The importance of having today writer Cali Fajardo as dean to open the floor. Speak to me about that.
Now, this is really fascinating. There were a number of colleagues on campus who approached us to say, we need to bring Kali here. Well, I knew that she was from the region, but I didn't really understand the significance until I was working with one of the librarians who read the book and was just so brought into his life being realized. And as Kali said in her presentation today, it was really an important way in which to do something that's just absent from the literature canon, if you will. As she mentioned, it's not a part of the canon. The lives of Chicana is and the like. And so for me, it was like, okay, this really has awakened some people on our campus that maybe we haven't paid enough attention to because of the way that I'm learning from my colleagues about why this is such an important book that we chose for the one book read.
What is this one book read? Explain to me.
Okay. So we're always trying to find as many ways as possible to bring out why we're working on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so having one read, it's like what cities do in terms of a whole city is going to be reading one book. Well, we're doing it on the campus level. And so we did it in that way. And this is one of the books that we chose. We've chosen articles in the past. This is our second book that we've actually done. And so we'll continue to, you know, mix it up in the ways in which we want to present information about diversity, equity, and inclusion and justice, and going from there.
That's Alphonse Keasley, who is the Associate Vice Chancellor in the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Community Engagement at CU Boulder, speaking there with KGNU's Rosanna Longo at yesterday's Diversity and Inclusion Summit. Cali Fajardo-Anstein was the featured author in KGNU and the Boulder Book Club's, Boulder Bookstore's rather, Radio Book Club. Now you can listen to an extended interview about her collection of short stories that really focus on the Chicana experience in Colorado. That's online at news.kgnu.org, or you can find them at the Radio Book Club podcast. Now, while you're looking for KGNU podcasts, you could also subscribe to the KGNU Trends podcast. It's our most recent addition to our podcast offerings. And the most recent episode that just was published last week takes a look also at issues of diversity and inclusion. It is 8:21. You're listening to KGNU. Well, tomorrow at Denver International Airport, Starbucks outlets and some other Starbucks stores around the city of Denver will see members of a local union handing out leaflets, alerting customers to the conditions of some of the workers are dealing with. This all relates to workers at concessions at DIA, including workers at Starbucks there. They're run by HMS Host, and they're petitioning to join Unite Here Local 23, a union that's helped other workers at DIA get an increase in their minimum wage to $15 an hour. The concession workers are hoping for the same result. I spoke with Lorenzo, who asked us not to use his last name, but he's a barista in the Starbucks on Concourse C at DIA. I asked him what difference having an increase to $15 an hour would make for him.
Well, I know for me that would have a significant impact because I'm a college student, so that would definitely help me alleviate some of the costs that I've associated with textbooks and things of that nature. And I'm sure a lot of other people, you know, that would help them immensely to be paid $2 more an hour.
I know there's also been issues where, you know, so many of the folks who are working there at those various different concession stands at the airport are immigrants and people of colour. And there have been issues where people can't speak their own languages. And I know Denver City Council has weighed in on that. Could you give us a sense of that issue?
Yeah, well, that's been a prevalent issue also, and that's really happened. There's been people that are speaking like their own like native language, which was like away from any actual like customers. It's just like in the back room or the back of the house, and you know, a manager who doesn't speak the language, you know, took offense to that and even like was trying to reprimand the employee for speaking his own preferred language.
What would you like listeners to know, Lorenzo, about what it's like trying to survive on that kind of a wage in Denver right now?
I would like the listeners to know, like, in my location, which is a very big location that revenues $15,000 plus a day, that there's people that work 40 to 50 hours a week that are homeless. I know of at least 4 cases, and those are just the people that are willing to reach out and tell me about, like, their life story and what's going on. You know, there's plenty of other people that are homeless that work for HMS Host. I could tell you in one particular case, there was somebody that was sleeping pretty much in a public area, and he was wearing his badge. And HMS Host, they provide you with this, like, what's called, referred to as a Micros card, and it has their logo, like, imprinted on it, which says HMS Host. And the manager didn't have an issue with the person really being, like, homeless. What they had an issue with them was that they were wearing their HMS Host badge and basically looking homeless. So they didn't like that their company was looking bad because this individual was homeless, but they did nothing to try to reach out and help that person.
That's Lorenzo. He asked that we don't use his last name, and he's a barista at the Starbucks on Concourse C at Denver International Airport. And this week he's joining hundreds of other concession workers at the airport employed by HMS Host in their efforts to join Unite Here Local 23. That's a union. They're hoping for better working conditions and an increase in their minimum wage to $15 an hour. Members of the union will be leafleting tomorrow at concession stands at DIA and at various Starbucks outlets in Denver with more information. And in fact, this week they have released a report into what's happening with the workers there, and we will post that at news.kgnu.org. It's time now for Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your thoughts heard before Congress. Donald Trump has no confidence in his own intelligence officials. On Friday, the president said new warnings of Russian interference in the 2020 election are nothing but a Democrat hoax. Intelligence officials said Russia plans to interfere in the primaries and the general election, and that the Kremlin favors Trump. Trump's response was to fire Acting Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire and replace him with U.S. Ambassador to Germany Richard Grenell, a Trump loyalist. Trump relies on the word of Russian President Vladimir Putin over his own intelligence. Russia has also been trying to intervene in the Democratic primaries to aid Senator Bernie Sanders. But Sanders denounced Russia, calling President Putin an autocratic thug. He said he would stand against any efforts by Russia to interfere in the vote. Quote, "The intelligence community is telling us that they are interfering in this campaign right now in 2020. And I say to Mr. Putin, if elected president, trust me, you are not going to be interfering in American elections." Russia's interference on behalf of both Trump and Sanders underscores its efforts to sow chaos. Revelations about House briefings enraged the president, who complained that Democrats would use Moscow's support for Trump against him. What are Senate Republicans doing about these continuing revelations of Russian interference in our elections? Well, they blocked an effort by Democrats to unanimously pass 3 election security-related bills last week. Democrats tried to get consent to pass 2 bills that require campaigns to alert the FBI and Federal Election Commission about foreign offers of assistance, as well as legislation to provide more election funding and ban voting machines from being connected to the Internet. But Senator Marsha Blackburn, a Republican from Tennessee, opposed each of these requests. Quote, "They are attempting to seize control over elections from the states." Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's legislative graveyard now includes a list of 10 recent election security-related bills that have stalled in the upper chamber. The Securing America's Federal Elections, or SAFE Act, the third bill Democrats tried to clear, authorizes more funding for election assistance and that commission, banning voting machines from being connected to the Internet and being produced in foreign countries. Quote, "Majority Leader McConnell has yet to take any concrete steps to protect our elections from hacking or foreign interference," Senator Wyden said. Wyden also argued that not having a nationwide ban on connecting voting machines to the Internet was like, quote, "stashing our ballots in the Kremlin." If you have thoughts on the SAFE Act or other election security measures, you can contact your senators. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
And it's time now for Naturally.
Greetings. Welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. A herb that's been in the news a lot lately is ashwagandha, Withania somnifera. What is this herb? What's it all about? Well, ashwagandha is in the nightshade family, so it is a relative of tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant, green pepper, red pepper, as well as deadly nightshade. So we want to make sure we're getting the right herb. Ashwagandha is used a lot in Ayurvedic medicine. The common name translates from the Sanskrit, meaning horse, and smells like a horse, which actually alludes to the virility of horses. Mm-hmm. So why is everyone gung-ho on ashwagandha? Well, the root is used primarily, and you can buy it in capsules and tablets and tincture, and it helps the body adapt to stress. It's very anti-inflammatory. It's an antioxidant, an aphrodisiac. It's considered a rejuvenative, a tonic for the hormones. And we know that it's been used for at least 3,000 years. It's a wonderful herb for people who are recovering from an illness like the flu or convalescing for any reason. One of the sayings in Ayurveda is to take ashwagandha for 15 days to impart strength to an emaciated body, just as rain does to a crop. We know that ashwagandha relaxes the blood vessels and promotes an overall feeling of well-being. It has long been used to enhance libido, improve fertility, and strengthen the adrenal glands. No wonder it's so popular. So it can help with nervous exhaustion and sexual dysfunction that's related to stress. And it also helps to counteract many of the diseases associated with aging. So a lot of people who work very hard and need to be creative and don't want to overuse caffeine might find that ashwagandha makes a great ally. It can be used for things like anxiety, depression, exhaustion, low back pain, premature aging. It does work as a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, so it can increase the availability of the neurotransmitter, dopamine. And so there's some 35 alkaloids in ashwagandha. It's an herb considered not to be used in large amounts during pregnancy. And if you are on antidepressants, you might want to talk to a health professional by using it. But how wonderful that nature provides us herbs that can do so many wonderful things. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.